So good evening, everyone. Near and far. Here in the Zendo on Wall Street and out there in your home Zendos, wherever you are. And welcome to anyone who is here for the first time. I think there are a few new folks here tonight. This happens to be the sixth and last installment of a Dharma seminar series that we've been doing that I have called What Does Love Have to Do with Zen? And the earlier talks are posted on the website if anybody wants to catch up, or at least most of them are. What we've been doing is looking at Buddhist perspectives and practices on love, as well as contemporary psychological understandings of how we develop the capacity for loving relationships and what constricts or impedes that capacity, that natural flow of mutual care and affection. And as I went into this topic, those of you who weren't here at the beginning, those who were will probably remember my saying that I realized that, you know, love is a word that's so casually used, even cynically used or avoided in our culture, that I almost have this feeling like in the Jewish tradition, you don't actually say the word God, you spell it, you G space or Yahweh, and then there's a space and D. Well, I feel that a little bit like that, like love, even to say it, kind of contaminates it almost. It's like, because it's such a, yeah, what was I said, you know, when we say, you know, I love your jeans, or, like, what does love really even mean? But we have been exploring that, and I hope getting a few insights along the way. And one thing that we've been doing is practicing with the Brahma Viharas, or noble abodes. Brahma Vihara means noble abode, one way to translate it. Also called the Four Immeasurables, which are metta, loving kindness, karuna, compassion, mudita, joy, and upekkha, equanimity. And with the sense that all four of those qualities are necessary and support our ability, our capacity to fully express and be in loving relationship with each other and with the more than human world. And we've been, over the course of these weeks, following approximately the kind of classical way that one practices with those qualities as meditative practices, starting by cultivating that quality, each one, towards oneself, and then to someone who is easy to care for, a dear friend or a mentor, and then to a neutral person, somebody that you don't have a strong or a charge one way or the other, positive or negative, towards, and then to a difficult person. Was it just last week we did difficult? Yeah, last week we practiced with the difficult people, people who even do a great, you know, terrible harm. You know, how do you do that? How do you know the Christian teaching to love thine enemies? How do we do that in this world? Even in small ways, even when we turn our nearest and dearest into an enemy in that moment, because in some way they've obstructed what we wanted, right? Or the way we wanted them to be. You know, in that small moment, we are activating the mind of enmity, right? So we did that. And then in the classic sequence, then you eventually extend that quality to very widely, you know, to the whole world, to all beings. And you do that, you start out by doing different groups or categories of beings. So tonight we'll practice opening our hearts as wide as the world, as the Vipassana teacher Sharon Salzberg says in her book, Loving Kindness, The Revolutionary Art of Happiness. She says the Buddha used two metaphors to teach his followers about the kind of spaciousness of mind required for loving that much. And the first image was of air or space, and the image that he used was throwing paint into the air. And I thought, paint? And then I have you ever seen, or maybe you've even been there to India, but photographs or films of Holi, where they throw these colorful powders into the air? That image came to mind. So I don't know exactly what the Buddha had in mind, but the sense was that the air doesn't change color itself. It doesn't, it remains unstained. And then the second image that the Buddha used was of a clear flowing river. And no matter what kind of material is thrown into the river, it won't burn. It will be cooled and doused by the water. So if you throw some flaming something into the water. And somehow these metaphors, she only just mentioned them briefly and not in a great detail, but I somehow was touched by an almost innocence of these metaphors coming from a time before human-caused toxic pollution had not pervaded the air and water to the extent that it has in our world now, so that the color of the air does change and the color, and water can flame with burning oil for a long time. So it made me wonder, so what metaphors would serve us now? Maybe a lot of us have by now heard about the work of researchers like the UBC forestry professor Suzanne Simard, who's been learning about the wondrous underground communication networks that connect trees through the mycelia of fungi, which send chemical signals between trees such that a kind of parent tree can nurture a young growing tree or a sick tree. Trees can redirect nutrients to a tree that's weaker, which is stunning, you know, that these trees live in community of mutual support in ways we never imagined. So maybe ecosystems can provide us with a kind of model for a love that goes beyond the usual spheres of care and concern that are focused on me and mine, you know, my well-being, my family, my society, my nation, those who are like me. Because ecosystems cross species, you know, they are incredibly complex the more we learn about them. And some of what we've been learning is really recent. And of course the earth as a whole is a kind of big organism system. So if we are to expand our sphere of loving kindness, and compassion most widely, we also need to expand our capacity for joy and equanimity, as we practiced last week, when thinking about the tougher cases, the difficult people in our lives. We need to. We definitely need equanimity, and we also need joy in our lives. to have that capacity, because compassion alone can overwhelm. The pain in the world is great. Or we can use Dogen Zenji's model that we talked about of the three minds. They're sort of the Zen equivalent of the Brahma-Viharas, maybe. Dogen's three minds are Kishin, joyful mind, Roshin, grandmother mind. Ro means just, sometimes it's Robashin, which is old woman mind, like so grandmother mind, or just Roshin, which is the nurturing mind, and magnanimous mind, which is the vast, spacious, equanimous mind. Daishin, great mind. So this is another set that together give us that full capacity for a loving relationship. And we also, if we're going to expand our heart that much, need to be able to rest in stillness. In our Zazen practice, in the silence, the stillness of not knowing, not grasping, allowing the 10,000 things to come forward and reveal themselves to us. And we need to be able to open to receive love. There's the love we receive from other people, which, as we noted earlier a few weeks ago, is sometimes clear and generous and unconditional, and sometimes it's conditional, right? And contaminated by clinging and aversion, and that's natural. We can't completely shut ourselves off to other people's love just because it's not perfect, right? And then there's the love, excuse me, there's the love we receive from the more than human world. Now, the very strict rational materialists would likely object to calling this love. They would even dismiss the affection we receive from our animal companions, our cats and dogs. They would dismiss as a conditioned response because we feed them, right? Now, I won't deny that the provision of food is an important part of our relationship with our cats and the morning demand for a laser tag from our younger cat. But what about when I'm sad? I'm not an easy weeper sometimes, but sometimes something will almost take me by surprise and tears will come. And that happened, I remember, right around the holidays. Just sadness welled up. And the younger cat just came in and went tap, tap, and then into the lap and just started to purr and look up at me and say, "Here I am, don't be sad." Right? Has anyone ever had an experience like that with a cat or dog? Yeah, you know? And what about that feeling when you walk in the forest? To me, it feels as if the weight of the world just kind of slips off my shoulders. You know that feeling? Almost like a gentle stroking. And I can't help but feel a kind of benevolence in those hemlocks and red cedars. Dogen Zenji, who, for those who may be new, was the Japanese monk who brought this form of Zen practice from China to Japan in the 13th century. And one of my very favorite of his texts is called Mountains and Waters Sutra. And he says, "Although mountains belong to the nation, mountains belong to people who love them. When mountains love their master, such a virtuous sage or wise person enters the mountains. Since mountains belong to the sages and wise people living there, trees and rocks become abundant and birds and animals are inspired. This is so because the sages and wise people extend their virtue. So he's describing a mutuality here, isn't he? And what is this resonance between the human inhabitants of the land and the land itself and its plant and animal inhabitants? Can we call it love? Dogen is definitely saying it's reciprocal. And certainly many indigenous, earth-based cultures have expressed this relationship in terms of kinship. Right? All my relations. Mutuality. This is one of the few times that Dogen uses the word love to express mutual care and affection. It's not about clinging. Although the word love is not used often in Zen writings, the word shin, which means both heart and mind, is throughout Zen literature. And the three minds, Dogen's three minds, Kishin, Roshin, Daishin, that shin is heart, mind. So our bodhisattva practice is implicitly all about love. The Islamic poet Hafiz wrote, "Just sit there right now. Don't do a thing. Just rest. For your separation from God, from love, is the hardest work in the world." So you don't have to call it love. In a way, as I said, this word love is kind of like the word God. To say it is to stain it. But it is mutual, sentient being reaching out to sentient being when separation drops away. Usually our defenses are up. We're too distracted to notice the love that is all around us. In the eyes of a stranger, or the laughter of a child, in the delicate fragrance of the cherry blossoms as you walk under the trees. Sometimes we have to be taken by surprise by love. And the poets say it best. So here's what William W.B. Yeats wrote this, my 50th year. My 50th year had come and gone. I sat, a solitary man in a crowded London shop, an open book and empty cup on the marble tabletop. While on the shop and street I gazed, my body of a sudden blazed, and 20 minutes more or less, it seemed, so great my happiness, that I was blessed and could bless. So there he is, just, you know, sitting there at J.J. Bean, just watching people, and suddenly takes him by a surprise. He loves these people. Yeah. And he feels their love in some mysterious way. And sometimes it's not people. Sometimes it's easier with animals. This is called, again, uses the word a blessing. This is by James Wright. Just off the highway to Rochester, Minnesota, twilight bounds softly forth on the grass. And the eyes of those two Indian ponies darken with kindness. They have come gladly out of the willows to welcome my friend and me. We step over the barbed wire into the pasture where they have been grazing all day alone. They ripple tensely. They can hardly contain their happiness that we have come. They bow shyly as wet swans. They love each other. There is no loneliness like theirs. At home once more, they begin munching the young tufts of spring in the darkness. I would like to hold the slenderer one in my arms. For she has walked over to me and nuzzled my left hand. She is black and white. Her mane falls wild on her forehead, and the light breeze moves me to caress her long ear that is delicate as the skin over a girl's wrist. Suddenly I realize that if I stepped out of my body, I would break into blossom. So see, we have to kind of be surprised with our defenses down sometimes, I think, when it comes to love. So I thought maybe we could do a little practice of just opening to receive love. So let's sit comfortably in your Zazen posture or in whatever way that's comfortable for you and well supported. And maybe let's close our eyes if you feel comfortable doing that. Either way, eyes open or closed. And just settle into the presence of your own body and breath. And feel your heart center as you breathe. You might even want to place your hand there so that you can feel connected to your heart. And then I'm just going to say some phrases and just see how they resonate for you. May I dwell in the open heart. May I attend to whatever clouds the heart. May I rest in stillness. May I open to receive love just as much as my heart is able right now. So now, if you'd like, just allow that feeling of openness, receptiveness to love to arise in whatever form it might come to you. Might be a memory of a person, a loving person, or it might be a place, an animal, companion. Or it might be a sense of more universal or spacious love. Just see what form it takes for you right now. And if you find that hard to evoke, even just try, just imagine. Imagine that feeling of being held in love. And offer that to yourself. May I dwell in the open heart. May I attend to whatever clouds the heart with kindness. May I rest in stillness. Ding. Mm-hmm. Actually, could someone pass the bell around for next time? Thank you, everyone, for doing that little practice. So, the greatest gift of love we can give the world. What do you think it is?
Authentic selves.
We love ourselves, and thus we can love everything.
Yeah. So to be able to do that, to be our authentic selves, with a capacity for love, we have to be able to see into, deeply into the roots of our own suffering, right? Our own greed, hate, and delusion. And let go of self-clinging. And that's the best gift we can give, right? Is to let go of self-clinging. And of course, this is a lifelong practice. We don't just do it once and for all. And that's why we need our bodhisattva vows to support us for the long haul. Because expanding this capacity for a boundless heart, as we've learned, involves healing the wounds of the heart. Letting the scar tissue that cuts us off from giving and receiving love dissolve, thin and dissolve. And really, after all, isn't that a matter of maturing into our full humanity? It feels like many of us humans are judging our own species pretty harshly these days. And there are reasons that we do. As we open our eyes to the magnitude of the harm that we've done to not only each other, but to the plant and animal realms and ecosystems upon which our lives utterly depend. But let's not forget that this capacity for love is our birthright. And the world needs us to affirm it and to recover it. So let's turn to the poets again to help us with some words to express this kind of mysterious power of love. So the Polish poet, Czesław Miłosz, that's my guess at pronunciation, writes this. Love means to look at yourself the way one looks at distant things, for you are only one thing among many, and whoever sees that way heals their heart. Without knowing it, from various ills, a bird and a tree say to them, "Friend." Then they want to use themselves and things so that they stand in the glow of ripeness. Doesn't matter whether they know what they serve. Who serves best doesn't always understand. So there's that not knowing. But I like this sense of ripening, the sense of ripening that he talks about. Jane Hirschfield is a wonderful American poet. I'm sure many of you know of her. She's a longtime Zen practitioner, and she writes this poem called Ripeness. Ripeness is what falls away with ease. Not only the heavy apple, the pear, but also the dried brown strands of autumn iris from their core. To let your body love this world that gave itself to your care, in all of its ripeness, with ease, and will take itself from you in equal ripeness and ease, is also harvest. And however sharply you are tested, this sorrow, that great love, it too will leave on that clean knife. So she's talking about love and loss here, isn't she? And ripeness, you know, fully ripening into our lives and letting go. Oh yeah, and there's these lines from Rilke, who says, love is at first not anything that means merging, giving over, and uniting with another. I think he's saying, you know, at first love is, you know, wanting and grasping. But then he says, it is a high inducement to the individual to ripen, to become something in themselves, to become world, to become world for themselves for another's sake. So again, this sense of ripening into a full capacity, even in the face of ultimate loss, right? This is my current favorite book on the Brahma Viharas practice by Christina Feldman. She's a Vipassana teacher. It's called Boundless Heart. And I just want to read you a little bit from her. Says the process of superimposing perceptions and its history of association upon anything or anyone is a process of constructing a world of finiteness out of a life which is fluid, dynamic, and ever-changing, a life that asks for a fluidity of responsiveness rooted in our capacity to see all things, all people, and ourselves anew. He's talking about this a kind of, yeah, fluid and dynamic and open capacity. And she said, even though we intellectually acknowledge the vulnerability of our body and our mortality, we find ourselves in denial, fear, and rejection of this truth, even as we nod our heads in agreement with the reality of impermanence and the instability of conditions we cannot control, it is deeply challenging for us to live in the light of what we know of impermanence. A world of distress is born in the ongoing argument we have with the unarguable. This argument is what we are invited to understand deeply and profoundly. An awakened heart and an awakened life are lived in the light of what we know. In the light of what we know of impermanence and no separate self, right? Learning to release our arguments with the unarguable is the greatest act of compassion we can offer ourselves and to the world. So that's another way of saying the greatest gift we can give is letting go of self-clinging. And she calls it releasing our arguments with the unarguable. Because we do argue, don't we? Mm. So there are more poems I wish I could share with you, but for now, let's take a few more minutes to give that, in just a small way, give that gift for a few minutes, offering loving kindness and compassion to the world, just as we are right now. You know, just as much, just, you know, in our little imperfect selves as we are. In doing Brahma Vihara's practice in the space beyond the personal, as I said, it's traditional to start beginning by extending groups to groups or categories of beings. So the classical groups would have been all women or all men, all enlightened beings, all unenlightened beings, beings in each of the six realms of existence, you know, the hungry ghosts and the hell realms, the animal realms, the human and the heavenly, etc. But we don't have to follow the classical categories. You can see what groupings actually come to mind that are present for you. And as when we do these practices for individuals, there are groups that will be easier to open your hearts to than others, right? Some categories of beings or people or humans that are easy to extend compassion towards, and others that are more challenging. And so as we do this, we attend to the states that arise in our own heart, and if difficult states arise in us, then we attend to them with patience and kindness and compassion. So let's just sit just a few minutes more. And again, close your eyes and settle into a sense of presence in your body and breath and heart. And then allow a particular group or category of beings to arise in your mind's eye. And then choose just two or three phrases that are meaningful to you. And say, you know, may all of that group be safe from harm, or be free from suffering. Just choose two or three phrases that are fitting and meaningful to you for that group. And stay with that group for a little while, and if then you want to let that group go and bring another group into your heart and mind, that's okay too. We'll just do this for just a short time. And just for another minute, or just a little bit more, please, if you wish, open your heart as wide as you can to include all beings. May all beings be free from suffering. May all beings live in peace. So thank you everyone for doing that little bit of practice together this evening. And please feel free to just adapt any of these practices that we've done over these weeks in ways that just work in your daily life. I'm a big fan of what I call street metta, or riding on the bus metta, or even driving on Highway 1 metta when somebody is rude. And don't let the words trip you up if you're more of a Zen type, and the words kind of get in the way. You can simplify it down to just one word and then even quieter till it's just the breath and just the feeling. So thank you, everyone. Let's do what we have done the last few weeks of this. And when we go around and do our round of each person saying their name, if you like, please also just say one little sentence of may, and some group, you know, of beings, some kind of beings, and your wish for them. Yeah, so I would say mine. I'm Kate, and we also usually invite people to say their gender pronouns if you wish. So Kate, my pronouns are she, her. And may all children be free from fear. May all children be safe from harm. So let's go around the Zendo first, and then we'll end over to the Zoom folks.
So, Michael, he, him. May those struggling with addiction